Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Before he was the hardest working man in show business, James Brown was the biggest hustler on the block. Whether he was shining shoes, scrambling to make new contacts in the bootlegging industry, or fighting, Brown simply saw himself as a unique talent, sometimes altering his life's details when it suited his all-consuming march toward a standout career as a performer. Brown certainly made his enemies along the way. An often violent womanizer who had various brushes with the law, Brown also turned his back on bandmates who threatened to step into his limelight. But friends and enemies alike had to admit, no one could take hold of an audience like the Godfather of Soul. Brown landed countless singles on the charts, and four of his recordings were counted among the 500 greatest albums, according to Rolling Stone. Thanks to an inventive mix of soul, funk, blues, gospel, and rock, Brown crafted a new sound that helped define several musical eras. Brown's outsized influence is recounted in R.J. Smith's book, The One, The Life and Music of James Brown. I recently spoke with R.J. Smith. R.J. Smith, welcome to the Roundtable.
It's great to be here.
Well, let's talk about the title of your book, The One. This really gets at the heart of the James Brown ethos, which was that he had a myth to exploit. Whether that myth was true or not seems sort of beyond the point.
Yeah. He was selling himself, clearly. He had a vision, and he knew how to market himself. He wanted attention, sometimes good, bad, it didn't matter. In terms of The One, it was a musical idea to him. It was a philosophy, and it was something that he always talked about, and he would never describe in detail. He would only say it was the secret to his music, and he would never explain exactly what it was.
So how much truth is there to the idea that he was a special person who was put on the earth to do this music? Because obviously, you know, we see him as a famous and very accomplished musician and a band leader and a performer. But early on, I mean, how much truth is there that he was a unique talent who was able to harness something different?
Well, I think the proof is in the music. He did stuff in, you know, what's amazing about Brown is in the 1950s, he shook things up and made great music. Speaking to vocal traditions of doo-wop and harmony singing. In the 60s, he didn't invent soul music by any means, but he was at the forefront of it. He helped define it and push it forward. In the 70s, he invented funk music as much as anybody. And then in the 80s, he still had hits on the charts. So he was constantly changing, reinventing himself, and by doing that, reinventing pop music.
Describe his process of doing so, because you make the point in the book that he couldn't really talk about music to the musicians in his band. He was more of a grand director of what it should sound like, and yet they still seem to find that place where it all worked together.
Yeah. Well, he talked a lot. He would talk a lot about music to the band and to the musicians in the band, but sometimes it was useful, and sometimes when he walked away, they would all scratch their heads and they had to get together on their own and say, well, I think what James meant was whatever. He was two things. On one hand, he did not have a formal music education. He couldn't read music or write it. He couldn't tell a key change or on the terms of a page. The other thing he was a musical genius. He felt when things were right. He had the gut that made him a huge hit. He made music that didn't always follow musical rules, and instead he broke the rules and made new rules.
How much of his success was the work ethic that he's so famous for? We all know the hardest working man in showbiz and how many concerts he would play, but how much of that was built by the stuff that happened offstage?
Yeah, well, the work ethic was hugely important to him, and He recorded a lot. He was on the road all the time. He was scheduled to go back on the road. The only thing that stopped him was he died in 2006. He thought he was going to live forever and work forever. In terms of work, well, I think when he grew up, he was born into incredible poverty. He lived basically on the streets of Augusta, Georgia, more or less raising himself. He was housed in a brothel that his aunt ran, and he had a very unhappy childhood that way. Kids teased him for the clothes he wore to school. So I think he got it in his head very early that he had to take care of himself, and the only way to do that was just to work harder than the next guy.
Tell me, if you will, about his relationship with Augusta, because it's a place that he goes back to again and again, but on the other hand, he was also banned from the city for 10 years.
Yeah, that's what's fascinating. And, you know, by the end of his life, Augusta had erected a beautiful statue to him, which is downtown now, and it's definitely worth a visit. At the same time, yeah, they threw him out back in the day when he was a teenager for breaking into cars and stealing clothes to wear. I think he felt comfortable there. It was home. It's one of those kind of feelings where, you know, home is the place you know you can go back to. And he always knew he knew how to navigate Augusta. He knew how to talk to people in that part of the country better than he knew how to talk to anybody else. He knew what people thought and felt there. But also the other side of it was, yeah, there was some defiance. He liked to, when people said he wasn't welcome, he would move in and put his feet up and say, well, welcome to you.
And you spend a good deal of time describing the circumstances that led to this area becoming a musical hotbed for James Brown and for others. What did the geography and the way people settled have to do with James Brown's upbringing, the sounds he was exposed to, and later his career?
One thing that's amazing about Brown is that, he was born in the Piney Woods of South Carolina, and then he walked with his dad and a relative to Augusta, 40 miles away, when he was about 9. And the amazing thing, well, it's American history. When the slaves came, they brought culture. They brought all kinds of music and a religion and a vision of the world. That whatever slavery tried to do could not break that down. It could scramble it. It could distribute it to different parts of the country. It could do a lot of terrible things, but it didn't kill that culture. And one amazing thing about Brown, he reconstitutes a lot of that culture, a lot of African-American culture that has roots all the way back to Africa. It's not like he sat down like a scholar might and try to make these connections and try to make a unified field theory about it all. He just did it. He just, coming out of the South as a poor African-American, it was in him, and he let it out, and we all felt it.
Identity for him was always an open question because, you know, he took a lot of his musical influence out of the church, but he wasn't particularly religious. He was into that early gospel music that he would hear on the radio, but he would later sort of mold that to his own career, even became close friends with Senator Strom Thurmond. It seems like he was always sort of trying to walk both sides of an issue, or maybe pulling himself out of completely being identified with one group or one mindset.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a couple ways you could look at that. As you say, it's there's a lot of contradiction there. At the same time, you know, I look at somebody like Bob Dylan, who we celebrate for all kinds of important things and amazing things that he's done with his art and his life. And one thing that we all tend to love about Bob Dylan is the way that he is so, you know, chameleonic, that he changed all the time, and when you thought he was going to go in one direction, he went another direction, and he might be born again for a while and then become, you know, incredibly, you know, non-religious for a while, and his politics changed, and then he didn't have... We think that's great when it comes to Bob Dylan, but I don't know anybody who's more chameleonic and kind of riding the currents of the culture and surprising the culture at the same time any more than James Brown. As you say, he was the guy that wrote Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. And he was a friend, a personal friend, of Strom Thurmond, an arch segregationist. He endorsed Nixon. He also endorsed Hubert Humphrey.
Right.
He's a hard guy to pin down.
In assembling this book, you interviewed hundreds of people who knew him and who worked with him. How is he remembered now that it's been several years since he's died? You know, are they fond of the experiences they shared with James Brown? Is there a lot of hurt that he left also?
Well, I'd say yes to both those. Yes to fondness, some fondness, a lot of fondness sometimes, and yes to a lot of pain too. You know, one fascinating thing, everybody that I talked to, they all had at least one amazing story. Like, everybody that got a picture of Brown, came home with like a funny or revealing or mind-blowing anecdote or scene they saw that they're still talking about. And the other thing was, everybody that I talked to, I pretty much always had a feeling, just a feeling, that they were, that they knew a lot more than they were telling, or something more that they were telling. In other words, it's that hurt feeling thing, and it's the secrets that people don't necessarily want to spill right away. He was a violent person. He used his fists a lot, and that definitely factors into people's memories of him. I think to the musicians that were in his band, I think they understand, down to the last musician, what an amazing talent he was. But it's pretty clear also Brown didn't share the spotlight. And the musicians that did the best and thrived in his band were those that understood that and knew what they could get out of the experience, playing amazing music and seeing the world, other things as well, some money, and knew at the same time what they were never going to get out of it. They were never going to be the star. They might not even get their name on the back of an album. So if you kind of understood that what you would get and what you could never get from that experience, you could thrive with Brown.
Tell me about his obsession with Elvis Presley and the way those two lives and careers parallel each other, but also are ultimately viewed incredibly differently.
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I think Brown identified on a personal level with Elvis, being a Southerner, being on the pop charts, being a very poor individual growing up. I think they had that kind of connection. And maybe as important, Brown saw Elvis as the other guy, the competition. America said Elvis was the king. He was number one. Brown thought he was the king. He was number one. And he just had to work hard and harder to show America what he already knew. So he looked at Elvis as a compatriot in a way, and as the competition in the other way. Yeah, so when Elvis died, you know, Brown went to Graceland and viewed the body and kind of famously said, you rat, you've left. Now you're dead and I'm alone here. Now I've got to carry the weight for both of us. I mean, he took it really seriously.
It's interesting to think just how much longer James Brown ended up living and having the chance to further his own legacy, where Elvis, it was cemented. He was dead, I think, at age 42, and that has been the narrative ever since.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think Elvis had a tighter time frame, and as far as I can tell, I mean, personally, I don't think Elvis made nearly as much amazing music as James Brown did. But America loves Elvis with a kind of unconditionality that it will not ever give to James Brown.
For you, how has experiencing the music of James Brown changed after finishing this project, which is a really vast reporting job and writing about a life that maybe hasn't been examined as much as many others in popular music? When you listen to James Brown now, knowing all that you know, do you hear it differently?
Well, I hear it with more respect and fascination than ever, really. I think that I grew up in Detroit, and I grew up listening to all kinds of music on the radio, Motown most of all, of course. And I love Motown. I love, you know, the Beach Boys. I love all kinds of pop music. But a lot of that music that I grew up with, or is a lot of the music today, Lady Gaga or Madonna or, you know, Will.i.am or whoever, can be great. But I feel like after you hear it a few times or a few years, you've got it. It's in your head. It doesn't grow. It's there, and you understand it. But something to do with the amazing complex rhythms and the band interaction with Brown's music, it's not fixed. The more you listen to it, the more you hear. And we haven't figured it out yet. We haven't got to the bottom of this amazing body of music. There's so much there. It's so alive. I keep listening to it, and I'm sure I will the rest of my life.
The name of the book is The One, The Life and Music of James Brown. We've been speaking with R.J. Smith, and the book is published by Gotham Books. R.J., a really great read, and appreciate your time.
Great talking to you. We'll be right back.
listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.